It's Wednesday, July 13th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 239 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 53 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
This is Wayne.
My name's Chad.
This is Chris.
And joining us today, we have two guests. First up, we have Derek.
Hello.
And Derek, you have joined us for a couple Fear the Cons, but I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about who you are precisely and what it is you're up to now, which is going to lead into what we are talking about on this episode. And I have a feeling this may go into a two-parter. So this episode and possibly the next episode as well.
Certainly. I am a longtime role player. I've actually been listening to Fear the Boot before Fear the Cons. I actually was at Fear the Con Zero. And this project that I'm currently a part of is creating a campaign setting and modules, possibly narrative books. In releasing them, they'll all be self-published. And this is something that I've been working on for the past 7 years. It's all been rolling in my head, and now I finally basically got the balls to put it down on paper. So,
and that's kind of the gist of what we're talking about here today, or what we're going to get to in just a couple minutes, which is going from zero to role-playing game. This is not a repeat of the design series. We still aren't brave enough to attempt that yet. What we want to do is for anyone out there who's interested in basically saying, look, I've got this idea. I'm willing to take the time and investment and energy to get this self-published or whatever, the steps you would need to do in going about this. And Derek is someone who's in the process of doing it, is going to talk about it. But then we're also going to talk about this with another individual who's on the flip side of this, which is Mr. Ed Healy.
I'm Ed Healy. From
Ed's, Hi, Ed.
Fear the Con.
Two and three. Yeah, you missed four.
From Dan's couch.
And you've also been on
That's
the show.
Hot.
You've also been on the show several times. But for anyone who's joining Fear the Boot for the first time, Ed is an industry veteran who's done quite a bit of work, particularly
on Noble Bear's lap.
Yeah, on Noble Bear's lap.
You mentioned Dan's casting couch, so I was going to ask you how that went for you.
He has too many wild animals. Well, like, yeah, there, so.
He still has scars. He's and a few bruises.
He's only a recurring guest, Chris, not a regular host. So you did better.
Nice.
Alrighty. Speaking of Chris
That's
doing
so gross.
Speaking of Chris and absurd things. Chris, you wanted to give a shout out, so just go ahead. I'm going to let this one speak for itself.
Excellent. I recently discovered that my nephew actually is involved in two of Pat's favorite things. One is crossing swords, the other being musical theater.
Now, you realize when Pat talks about crossing swords, it has nothing to do with steel.
And that's why I mentioned it. No, it's
harder than
my,
steel.
My nephew
yeah,
apparently
exactly.
got the lead role in Highlander the Musical. No, I'm not kidding. It's going to be done in Minneapolis and has a website, and I'll make sure that Dan gets that for the show notes. But the performances are coming up here in late July and early to mid-August, and I'm actually planning on trying to going, and maybe, who knows, maybe I'll even try and organize some sort of booth.
You said performances?
Performances, yeah, they're doing multiple.
There could be only one.
Well, you see, it's funny because...
They must have a whole lot of stand-ins.
Now, you say your nephew's got the lead, right? Lucky bastard.
Fear the Boot. Now with more glee.
Yeah.
No, they're
Can you imagine how many understudies they must have for that cast?
What?
My God, Chris.
It's with Highlander.
It's the Highlander. They all die.
Pat, I have in my life had nothing to do with theater, and even I know enough theater to know what an understudy is and to appreciate the joke.
I know.
So I just want you to know it wasn't lost on everyone listening to the show.
I just feel like it wasn't me trying to make the joke.
I was actually talking, so I had no idea what he was saying.
All right, so if you're interested in hearing a musical about Highlander...
Yes, apparently they're taking a comedic take on this whole thing. Their tagline...
Is there any other way?
Yeah, if this was a Highlander musical and was going to take itself seriously, this would be like the biggest bunch of...
Dude, I don't think there is a serious musical.
So morbidly curious.
When I first heard about this, I thought, oh, they're taking the Queen soundtrack. They're going to integrate that into the show. And I thought, okay, all right, that's fine. But then I went to the website and discovered... As soon as I read that their tagline was, there can be only one singular sensation, I knew that they were not taking this very seriously. So
Queen is providing the soundtrack to this thing?
I'm betting not.
Yeah, I think Freddie Mercury personally is.
I think the music is all self-produced.
I think the music they're going to do is a lot like Freddie Mercury, dead. But I have a feeling. I don't know anything about this musical. I haven't seen the website. I certainly haven't seen it. I'm willing to go out on a limb here and bet this is not something that's officially sanctioned, and it is protected under satire and parody of copyright.
It sounds fun, though.
Oh, sure, sure.
Honestly, I'm very intrigued, and it sounds interesting. And yeah, this sounds like experimental theater kind of thing. So who knows? We'll see.
If they don't have Rutger Hauer, I'm not interested.
Well, Rutger Hauer wasn't in Highlander.
I'd go.
He wasn't like in any of them. No.
It's Highlander. Oh, okay. Why wouldn't you go?
My bad.
Exactly.
Now, when they come out with a split second musical,
nah, yeah,
I'm going to see it.
That's right.
Just
that's
for
right.
the split second. We need big gun song.
So
I want to hear that turn
like
into a
Back
song.
To the Future right. Highlander hybrid. No, I would go see that. That would be a great show.
Lord,
be a great game.
One.
Now you're getting into something really scary. You're getting into musical fanfic. And I think you...
And you're also blending genres, and Chad hates that stuff.
Ed, you need to back away from that cliff, man. You have too much to live for to get into, musical fanfic.
It's like a car wreck, right? You can't look away, even though you know it's wrong to watch. I would go to see something like that. But I would never put any of my money to support something like that, but I would gladly go see Back to the Future.
You would sneak in the exit to go watch this movie. You'd like totally sneak into the theater.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I could see that.
Okay.
So, Dan, let's
see you in August.
Let's get this show back on track.
You left out one particularly important detail. What city?
Minneapolis.
It's the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. I can't remember the theater offhand, but yeah, Minneapolis-St. Paul area.
All of the 49 states aren't allowing it, so.
No, when?
It's off, and that's it.
the lights got turned off. They couldn't pay the bills.
Yeah. I bet it's still better than Spider-Man.
Seriously,
musical.
When? Like, when is this masterpiece going to air, you know?
Late July and early to mid-August.
So this is coming up here pretty soon.
Yeah, it's coming up here pretty soon. I'm probably going to try and shoot for the August 12th showing. There's going to be sword fighting and everything, so it should be interesting, to say the least.
You're going to have to give us an after-action on this. I guess if you live in the Minneapolis area and are either really into Highlander, really into musicals, or just...
Self-abuse.
Want to burn your retinas.
Yeah, you just... are really weird, then we'll post a link in the show notes. Go check it out. I can't say this is appealing to me, but you know what? Chris's nephew's in on this, so I'm not going to bag on it too hard.
He's actually a very skilled actor. He's pretty good at what he does.
And you know what? This may be great, because here just maybe, was it about a month or two ago, I went with Chad and Carl to see the Weird Al concert.
Yeah.
And I did this mostly because Carla really wanted to go, so I'm like, fine, I'll just support my wife, blah blah blah.
I wanted to go because I've seen Weird Al in concert before and he rocks.
Yeah, well, and his song, well, where I was at is, you know, songs were funny in the 80s. He's probably gonna do a bunch of costume changes and just go through his songs and then we're done, but he doesn't. It's like a show.
Yeah,
his music is only about half of what occurs. He has like video bits, and by videos I don't mean music videos, I mean like video spoofs he's done. Mm-hmm. He has all kinds of like audience interaction. He interacts with his band. He made a believer out of me. I walked in there like, I'll suffer through this for Carla's sake, to I want to go back next year.
That's right.
So I will totally say up front that, Chris, as much as I'm right now rolling my eyes, it could be this Highlander musical is the funniest freaking thing that mankind has ever produced. And anyone in the Minneapolis area would be missing a treat by not seeing it. So don't take my annoyed cynicism for gospel truth. You should the rest of the time, but not in this one case.
I skipped my high school prom to see Weird Al in concert.
My first time I saw Weird Al was 1984, back when he was still growing for his 3D tour. Mm-hmm. I even bought a tour shirt.
Quick reminder about Gen Con. Once again, we got that coming up here in just like, what, 2 or 3 weeks now or something to that effect.
Yeah.
Fear the Boot will be sponsoring This Just In from Gen Con. I'll provide a link to that. If we do not get another show in the hopper prior to Gen Con, the interview we do with Just In may be the episode we release for that week. So just fair warning. The other thing is, of course, the Toft Bitch Network is still out there. So if you want to get in there and join us for dinners or pickup games or whatever, be sure to get signed up for that network and make sure your user profile includes a cell phone number, because they typically get the word out on events via text messages. All the links you'll need will be provided yet again in the show notes, so you can just check there at feartheboot.com to get all that. So from there, let's get right down to brass tacks. We've got, looks like here, seven major subjects. I do mean major subjects. Ed was commenting prior to recording that this could be the...
We have seven hosts.
We do. Maybe we should each take one. I'll start with the first one then, even though I have no idea why I would particularly start with the first one. When truth be told, the only one in here I'm maybe actually uniquely qualified to talk about is the fourth one.
Because everybody has the scorecard in front of them.
Oh, yes, yeah, yes, no, absolutely.
Yeah. They're like, oh, yes, Dan, you're correct. The fourth one, totally you.
Absolutely. But anyway, we are going to talk about these 7 points, and Ed was commenting prior to recording, these could be the table of contents for a whole series of shows. I don't know if it's going to go that far, but let's get down to it. So what we're talking about here is going from zero to RPG, the idea being that you are in the situation that Derek is working through, which is you are sitting there, you have this great idea for an RPG, you've gotten past the delusions that Wizards of the Coast is going to pick you up and make you the next multimillionaire in gaming. Let me go and break it to you. There aren't any multimillionaires in gaming. Or if they are, it's
don't
not...
Don't they actually have to get that themselves before they can pass that on?
You would think.
Create a game that sells, you know?
Well, yeah, since Wizards of the Coast isn't like laying people off right now or anything. So if you've gotten past those delusions, but you're like, you know what? I love my game enough that I just want to see it in print and, you know, maybe sell a few dozen, a few hundred copies, maybe even take that risk that it might be kind of a big indie hit or something, and you're willing to invest some of your own stuff in it. How do you get into that? And we're going to skip past the stage of concepting the game, because this topic is going to presuppose you already have your basic idea, your basic setting, your basic rules. What you are looking to do is to take this to market. So let's start off with step one. And Derek, since you gave us this topic, I'm going to kick it straight to you. Point number one here is the process of actually writing the game. And I want to stress, we're not talking just per se about designing the game, but about actually taking these ideas, getting them out of notes and out of your head and onto paper in a consumable format.
The first thing that I need to stress is that you need to not necessarily rely, but lean on your friends, because they can be very useful, cheap labor. And especially with the writing process, if you need like stats or characters or backstory, they can really help with that. But as far as the writing process is concerned, you have to be very organized. So I actually outlined, and I'm going to talk specifically on the module that I created, how the flow would happen from beginning to middle to end. And then as you're writing it, literally just write. Don't worry about spelling. Don't worry about anything else. Even if something makes completely no sense whatsoever, just write and get the first draft, because I can tell you that that first draft is a pain in the butt to get out.
That's good advice for writing anything at all, too. I mean,
yeah,
it's get through that first draft, then come back and edit.
And you'll be surprised sometimes, like, side plots will come out of that process. I know that one of the side plots for the module came out just out of the blue of, like, I'm writing this and I need another character in here to do something, and blah, the character gets inserted. And why is that character there? Okay, now I have a subplot. As soon as you have an idea, just start writing. It doesn't matter if it takes 20 pages or 2,000 pages, just write and get through it. That's pretty much step two.
There's a couple of things that you brought up in there that I want to stress or expound upon. Let's start with the outline. If this is a game, what you are trying to do, obviously, is communicate a setting, a rule system, an entire game experience to people who are not in your head, are not in your gaming group. They may have no contact with you whatsoever at any point in their life. In fact, they may get this game not by seeing somebody else play it, but by picking it up raw off of Amazon or RPG Now or their local game store or whatever. And as a result, you have to have a structure to this book that is going to clearly sell that is going to lay that out in nice, systematic fashion. And there are considerations, and Ed, this is probably where your expertise is going to help us out here, but I know there are considerations in the way the book is structured. For example, one of the classic pieces of advice I've always heard is always put character creation up front, or very close to the front. And the thinking I've always heard for that is, especially with a player, not a game master, the thing you're trying to sell them on, or that they want to know, is when I play this game, what can I be and what can I do? And so therefore, one of the first things you have to hit them with is character creation, so they start to see things that they can latch onto and envision themselves doing.
You know, Ron and I just helped develop a book for a Traveler third-party publisher, and we started with some other considerations, but as far as structure, yeah, we put the player section first. It was like the very first thing. You can see people do that in, you know, a lot of the core books out there, but don't forget that, you know, you need to put some of those player hooks throughout the book, or you need to break that player's section out as its own little product, because otherwise the players are not going to have anything useful in the rest of the book. Now, it depends on, obviously, if you plan on selling 10 copies or 1,000 copies will determine how kind of draconian you are in that. But I actually think that the structure of the book and how you use that to convince people to stick with you and enjoy the experience and therefore, you know, recommend it to their friends is something you need before you start putting pen to paper. There's other considerations. Of course, for us, one of them was, you know, the joy of opening the book itself if you plan to print it. If it's PDF, it's not as big of a deal. But things like if it's a monster section and you've got 12 pages for 12 monsters, let's say, why don't you just enforce a rule where you fit one per page? It makes it a lot easier to use. There's guys like Adam Jury from Posthuman who are extremely interested in the book as an artifact, a usable element, and how that affects the usability of the book. And they're right. You know, I mean, things that may seem mundane, such as, you know, how many pages per section or how many words per page or where things go, are things that you need to think about if you're going to start making a game, because it's not just a novel.
One of the things that I think it's sort of maybe intuitively put in there is also eye flow. Typically in Western cultures, we go left, right, top to bottom, but there may be a case where, especially you have like stat block with pictures, I found that it's easier for my eyes if it almost takes a serpentine pattern. So I put like art on the left on one description, art on the right on the next one, then on the left. It almost flows like water. I didn't really consciously think of that. After I looked back at that, it was just like, oh yeah, that actually feels a little bit better reading it for some reason.
Derek, did you actually start with a structure, or did you just put pen to paper or finger to keyboard and then try to fit that into a structure?
Because it's the first one, I actually created the structure as I was writing, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I had a template and I just filled in the template. I looked at what I was doing, like there's a certain block where you have sort of read aloud text, and there's another block which has like abbreviated monster stats. There's a term in Word where you can create these little word snippet blocks with formatting. So I did that as I was going along.
Something else I'd like to emphasize for the writing process that you mentioned, Derek, is the importance of editors. Once you have this game done, or at least you have a first draft done, it doesn't hurt to start by circulating this around friends and family, especially if you have friends and family who have a good eye for grammar, spelling, flow, layout, design, whatever. Even if you don't, you know, if they're gamers, they can give you some kind of an opinion. Beyond that, though, and doubly so, if these are people who are just going to tell you they love whatever you do because they're your friends, don't hesitate to get out there, to get involved in various forums or whatnot. Talk to people who have experience in the industry, not per se because you just want to follow exactly what they've done, but because these are people who have found out the hard way what does and doesn't work. But I want to pause on that point here for a little bit because of the fact that I think doing what we do and having done it as long as we have, it's easier for us to say, yeah, go talk to this designer or that whatever. But just because we know who they are doesn't mean the average person at home has their, you know, and I'm not trying to sound like a braggart here, but it's just doing what we do. I have contacts that I realize a lot of people, especially people starting out, whether it's game design or podcasting or whatever, don't have. And how do you go about tracking down people who have really good skills in the areas you may be lacking?
There's a number of avenues that you can pursue. I mean, you're bound to know in your circle of friends somebody who has an English degree they're not using.
Hey, those come in extremely useful at Pizza Hut.
Does anyone have one that's using one?
You know what? They're about as useful as theater degrees, okay? And that's what I've got. So what I'm saying is you have avenues certainly where you can start asking it around. On top of that, there's English professors at universities that you can at least contact, which is not nearly as difficult or intimidating as trying to contact someone within the industry. Going along with that, though, what you do have to do is you have to put yourself out there and your project out there and talk about, you know, what it is exactly that you're doing. And that itself may have a little bit of intimidation factor, because suddenly now you have to actually really reveal what it is you're working on. But if you can get past that, there are places where, and yeah, it may not be professional paid help that you might find, but it's better than nothing.
You know, I've found that the two things that help me the most are, one, developing relationships, and two, just being helpful. If you know that you're going to need help someday, asking somebody out of the blue that you've never had a relationship with, chances are slim to nil, unless they're just, you know, white knights, that you're going to get that help. The reason that, like, the guys in Fear the Boot could probably pull off some of that is because they've developed a relationship over a long period of time with a group of people. And, you know, the podcast is helpful. People have found good information. They've had a good time, whatever. I mean, I know that someday I will publish another game. I haven't published anything since I was at Eden Studios, so it's been a while. But knowing that, you know, I spent a better part of the last couple of years getting to know some of the retailers out there. I haven't been pestering them for anything, really. I've just been calling up, asking them how business is and what's selling, what's not selling. Sometimes I'll go visit them, even if I don't, you know, I'm not from their town, because I recognize that, you know, it would be nice if the day that I have a new game out there that I've got a bunch of people I have relationships with, that I might be able to, I don't know, get them to order some of them and put them on the shelves. But likewise, if you've got a blog or if you're on forums or whatever, and you're just silent and you don't say anything, you don't help anybody, somebody needs something and you know the answer, but you don't pipe up and do it, or you know somebody that could help somebody and you don't make that handoff, the chances are that when you need help, nobody's going to help you either. So, you know, be helpful, get out there and don't be shy, and start developing those relationships. And it doesn't even hurt, you know, if you're on Twitter or Facebook or on the forums on Fear the Boot, to just say, hey, you know, do you guys know anybody who does layout? I could use some advice. That single question might get you five responses and one person that you hit it off with that you may or may not ever use, but they might be able to turn you on to somebody who would. So, one, you can't be quiet, and two, you should be helpful.
And there's also a lot of free advice out there if you know where to look for it. For example, Ryan Dancy loves writing blogs and Facebook posts and such about the rights and wrongs and the ins and outs of designing a game. Now, not everybody agrees with all of his assessments, and that's part of advice, is not have to agree with all advice.
And it's worth every penny you pay for it.
Exactly. But nonetheless, there's a lot of stuff out there on this. You know, you want to learn a little bit about grammar, a little bit about, you know, art and such. I mean, there's books out there that will help you with this kind of stuff. There's a lot of people out there that are willing to talk on this. Heck, go to someplace like Gen Con. This is where you have a great opportunity to interact with people from a variety of companies. This is how I got to know Shane from Arc Dream. I just walked up to him at Gen Con and just started talking to the guy. Now, granted, I recognize once again, the press pass I carry made that a little bit easier. But nonetheless, if you walk up there as a fan and you say, hey, tell me about how you put this book together. Tell me about your thought process on it. You know, walk me through the what you guys did. You may get a ton of really interesting nuggets just out of that time spent engaging these people. And there's a lot you can get from that if you're just willing to get your hands dirty and do it. If you have the attitude coming into this fresh that you've got it all figured out, you are one of two things. You are either the messiah of gaming, or you are about to turn out a really crappy product because your own arrogance never slowed you down enough to ask for help.
One other place I would suggest is Origins. It's a little bit more intimate, and there's a lot of new startups that cannot really afford some of the costs of Gen Con. So Mooney Labs, for instance, has a huge room in there every year, and you may be able to find a little bit more of the indie type of group at Origins.
I've heard the same thing about Dreamation as well in New Jersey.
Two other bits of advice I would give is, one, when you go out to seek editors, and whether these are people who are going to review your writing, review your design, give you comments in general, be sure that these are people who are going to be honest editors. I do not agree with the old adage that friends and family make terrible editors. I think certain friends and family make terrible editors, either because, one, they have no idea what they're talking about, or two, because they're going to love what you do no matter what it is because of the fact that they're your friends. Or maybe it's not that, but they just think too much like you do. But I think if you have friends and family who are different enough from you and will give you honest feedback, they're a great place to start. I don't think you have to stop there. I think there's a point where you can take these people who have been great resources to you, whether it's random people on forums or somebody from an established game company, and say, hey, could you look this over? And they may provide you some edits as well. But the second half to this advice is then when it comes back, you've got to toughen up and take the edits. When they give you that stuff back, you have to be able to say, look, the fact that they criticized quite a bit of my product, instead of getting depressed, instead of going into a tailspin, instead of whatever, I'm going to take this, I'm going to incorporate it, and I'm going to make this a better product, regardless of the amount of work that's going to take or whatever, and move forward. You can choose to ignore that, but once again, if you choose to ignore all the advice you're getting, you do so at your own peril.
Be grateful to these people, because as I was told when I was taking a writing seminar, they're your best friends. And even though it's going to hurt, it's going to be worth that pain in the end.
I think really one of the things that you need to take, you know, with that editing and that criticism that you may get from these people that do it, you have to look at that with an open mind of, well, if this one person had all these problems or issues with this, then what problems are other people going to have as well? It's just like, this is an indication of, oh, maybe the stuff I wrote wasn't pure gold the first time out of the gate. So it's just a corrective process. It's an improvement. It just goes back through the mill. It's just like anything. Right. You throw it back in there, fix a few things. You throw it back out there, fix more things. And eventually it gets to be where it's more acceptable to all.
And I also want to give a counterbalancing piece of advice. We've talked about how people may be unexpectedly helpful and you ought to pay attention to your editors. But I do want to briefly hit on the flip side, which is, in the information age, everyone has an opinion, oftentimes an unwelcome one. And so I'm going to forewarn you, when you put yourself out there, part of putting yourself out there is people are dicks, okay? Just be prepared for that. Fear the Boot has had wonderful success. If you go on iTunes, we also have negative reviews. We appreciate all you that go out there and put positive ones, but nonetheless, people are dicks, okay? Just get prepared for that. And along those lines, editors are not automatically right. You, as the person who is taking the time to create this product, to put your money behind it, to put your heart and soul behind it, you have to make that final decision. Where if your editor says, hey, you need to change X, but you've looked it over with an objective mind and you think they're wrong, guess what? They're human too. They very well might be wrong. That role as editor does not make them an infallible source of truth.
Well, I think it's also good to get it out there in front of multiple editors. The more, you know, the
look
more
for
editors,
trends. Yes.
Yeah, the more editors, the better. Then you take all that data back. You look at what everybody did and you look for patterns. Like you said, if 75% of the edits are consistent, that's good. You throw out the errant ones. And, you know, so, you know, the more eyes, the better.
Sounds like a playtesting advice
well,
as well.
Well, let's go ahead then. Let's roll right into point number two, which is playtesting. Derek, you want to kick this one off? There's lots to say on playtesting. But
oh, my God, yes. yes, playtesting just became essential when I was doing this module. Certain the story points didn't flow as well as I'd hoped, but as soon as my players were working through it, I was like, okay, well, you would also see me in the GM chair, like, crossing out entire paragraphs that just didn't go there. And at the end of each session, the players and I would sit together and I'd ask, okay, what worked? What didn't work? How can I improve it? Like, for instance, at the very beginning of the module, there is a scene where a group of farmers are running with a child up to the town guards. And there's a certain thing that has to be emphasized, and it wasn't at that point. It was not clear to the players throughout that first part. And then at the end, they were like, okay, no, you really need to change this part. By working it with your players, then I believe it becomes a much stronger module because they're looking at it purely from a player's standpoint, not from you who knows everything from the very beginning. It's like, oh, that is obvious because,
yeah,
of course it is.
What works, what doesn't work, what's clear, what isn't clear, what's frustrating. I can't emphasize that enough. And certainly start with your own gaming group. There is no harm in that whatsoever. With Skies of Glass and Epoch of Risos, both in their current incarnations, I have playtested them with my groups, and my groups have given me wonderful feedback on things that work, things that don't work, things they want to see change. Their ideas that they have come up with whole cloth, for which I will, should these ever get published, properly provide credit saying, yeah, so-and-so invented this. The other thing that I would say, though, is don't stop there. If you want this thing correctly play tested, you need to put this in front of somebody who knows nothing about it, who has not been prepped by playing it with you or hearing you talk about it, but who is the same as a consumer grabbing this raw from the shelf of a store, taking it home and being like, what the heck does this even mean? You know, this whole section's busted. Why is there no index in the back? That's my big axe to grab.
The primary reason for that is you don't even realize that you're mentally filling in these gaps that aren't there. You won't get that proper perspective and feedback until you give it to somebody else who, yeah, has essentially picked it up off that shelf. And they look at it and they realize, you know, whoa, wait a second. You went from point A to point C. What the hell happened to B? And then you realize, oh, my gosh, I never even put that in there. You know, and then you have to go back and make sure that you cover those bases when it comes to those kinds of things. Because you will mentally fill in your own stuff as you're running it and testing it.
Cons are going to be your best friend for playtesting outside your group. Fear the Con, Gen Con, Dragon Con, all those cons, because it's a very diverse set of people that you probably do not know, and it's just a great way to just have different sets of eyes on it.
Well, and I think also if you've got people you've really built these relationships with, and for this, you can use anyone. You don't need someone who's an expert in the game industry. You may even get someone who's brave enough to run the game, who's never seen it before. For example, at Fear the Con 4, Mikey Mason ran a great Skies of Glass game. Now, he did not use the rule set I'm working on, but quite frankly, that's my own fault. They're not in a consumable form right now. But had I given him consumable rules, I fully believe he would have used them. And so here's a guy who is not part of my regular gaming group, who is not intimately involved in all of my random projects and whatnot, who could have taken these rules, sat down, played them, and run the game. And I could have sat there and observed the whole thing from a player's perspective and suddenly seen someone outside of my head working through my rules and seeing where they struggle, what works, what doesn't work, what the group loves, what they hate. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Cons are a great place to find random people to toy around with your stuff.
I think related to that too, Dan, is if you are able to within your regular playtesting group, or if you can solicit players, you know, via your FLGS, you've got to find a power gamer. If it's for a licensed system, obviously this is going to be a little bit easier, but if it's for a system you're designing, give it to a guy that you know is a power gamer. Let them look at it. They have the ability to find those things in there that allow
everything exploitable in the rules.
Yeah, exactly. To completely and utterly break the rule system. And you need somebody like that. They might be really annoying as players, but they become an incredibly valuable asset when you're designing your own rule system, because they will. They'll exploit those things and point out glaring weaknesses that exist within your rule system or within the adventure itself.
There's a reason why the government hires so many hackers straight out of jail.
Yeah, they know what they're doing.
Exactly. You may have hated them for what they were doing before, but guess what? They know what they're doing. And in the same way, people like that guy, they may be the bane of every game you run. But when you're writing a game, you're absolutely right, Chris. Put them down and say, okay, I want you to attempt to break this game and see what they come up with. Now, having said that, I do realize that depending on the type of game you're putting out, you may at some point say, look, I'm trying to write a game that's entertaining, not have 50 pages of unnecessary legalese to protect the game from an obvious abuse. And so I'm not suggesting you go that far, but certainly see, you know, look for the obvious gaping Spielbergian plot holes in your stuff that you need to fix up.
Well, honestly, you just need to get used to playing your game, because when you finally publish it, the only thing that's guaranteed to get people to play it is to you get out there and demo the crap out of it. Games are meant to be played. And there's no way to know whether it's a game worth playing unless people actually put pen to paper and dice to table.
Yeah, it's funny. It's been out of print for about 20 years. You have any idea how many copies of the Star Trek FASA game I have sold? And I've done it by running them at conventions. There's one here, Derek, that you threw out, which I may or may not be an issue depending on what you're trying to do. But I think nonetheless, it's worth talking about here, which is dealing with established licenses. Now, of course, there's two angles you can talk about this from. One may be a system license. The other would be setting elements. So with the system, we know, for example, there are a variety of things like the OGL, where you need to sit down and carefully read through what it does and doesn't allow you to do. Or if you can't understand it, find someone who's good with the legalese to explain it to you. But you need to do your research there. In the case of established setting elements, for example, let's say you want to write the role-playing game for your favorite TV show. Obviously, this gets a lot more complex. So, Derek, I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about what you're going through with that.
My situation is a little bit different in that I'm not creating an actual game system. I'm creating a campaign setting. So I'm using an existing system, which is the Pathfinder system. So I had to go on their website, register as a company, and promise to send them the a printed or a PDF copy as soon as I produce it. But they also have a list of books that they produce that I can use, the content in which I can use. Then another thing that just came up was stat blocks for characters. I used something called Hero Lab, basically to do the math of the different levels and so forth and abilities. And the output of all that processing, I was concerned because there really wasn't a whole lot of information from Wolf Lair about could I use that in a sellable product, could I not. So I actually had to contact them, and they're like, we'd never really thought about that. And and then they created this Powered by Hero Lab process so I could put their stat blocks into my modules and campaign setting books and all that. But you just really have to be careful, because if you step on the wrong set of toes, it could get expensive and it could get really painful. So I've been really trying to be careful about whose stuff I use, and making sure all the credit goes properly, make sure that their copyright goes in the right place, their logos go in the right place, so forth.
Yeah, if you don't know, ask. If you still don't know, don't. Because you are a hell of a lot better off just having not dug that hole than finding yourself in it.
That's always been one of the things that I've struggled with when I think about releasing a product, is the copyright page and all that stuff in there, because it's just so foreign to me, you know, how to format all of that.
Yeah.
They'll actually give you a set of text. You basically copy and paste into it where they say that you need to put it. So it's either inside the front cover, or maybe the last page, or so forth. And at least Paizo and Wolf Lair have given me a lot of specific instructions. This is what you need to do.
Yeah, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not going to pretend to be, but I do know enough to tell you that the law changes substantially once money gets involved. If you're writing a fan-made product and all you're doing is putting it out there for free, and you're not taking large portions of their material and simply reprinting it, you're actually creating original content. A lot of times, as long as you credit where it came from, you can probably get away with, or at the very least, even if they get mad about it, they're not going to do a whole lot. When you're selling it for money, everything about this changes, and you better have your ducks in a row. So once again, if you are choosing to get involved with an established system or an established setting, you need to contact those people. And if you are not able to get the clearance or responses or whatever you need to move forward, just don't do it. It's better that than ending up on the defendant's stand. I mean, it's really that simple.
Yes, absolutely. But the people I've talked to have been really, really nice. They've been very helpful. They've gotten back to me, and it's been a very responsive process, which surprised me and made things a lot easier.
Let's talk about some other legal concerns here. This takes us down to bullet point number four, other legal concerns. Let's start off with forming an LLC or forming a corporation of some kind. I want to stress, of course, that the details on this are going to vary from state to state, because while it's my understanding there are some federal laws that govern corporations, for the most part, they're established and regulated at the state level. So once again, you're going to want to consult somebody who's in the know on such things. That could be an accountant, that could be a lawyer, that could even just be a friend who's made a real life study of this stuff. That's up to you. But let's talk about the reasons for forming a company and the steps you are likely to see in most states surrounding forming a company.
Reason number one, you don't want to lose your house.
Reason number one, what they call the veil of liability or something to that effect.
Yep.
Right now, and not that I'm flaunting this, but if Fear the Boot did something, there is a Fear the Boot company. There is actually a Fear the Boot corporation. As a result, if somebody came after me and sued me for $25 billion, what they would get is the assets of Fear the Boot. They would not get the assets of Dan Repperger. If I did not have that, then I can, once again, this varies from state to state, then I could not guarantee that level of protection to where they could not come after my personal assets in addition to whatever I made off the product. Veil of liability is a big place to start with that. It's not the only reason, though.
Yeah, no, you also want to make sure you keep your finances for the business separate from your personal finances. Opening up an account in the LLC is important. That way, the monies don't get confused and it's easier to report. The reason why I started an LLC is actually because of my accountant. They were the ones that suggested I go to the Secretary of State, which in this case, I'm in Indiana. I go to the Secretary of State. I start up a sole proprietary LLC and pay a whole bunch of money to them. And and then afterwards, I have to get something called a Federal Employer Identifying Number, an FEIN, from the IRS.gov. And that's free to get that. But you have to have the LLC and its information before you can do the FEIN. And then you have to worry about sales tax and so forth.
And if this sounds complicated, it can be, which is why if you have the ability to do so, getting an accountant or a friend who's in the know is going to help you quite a bit. But it is worth it, not just for the veil of liability, but for the reasons Derek's talking about as well, which is every year it helps my taxes quite a bit because of the fact that while I have to declare Fear the Boot's income, which mostly comes in the form of ad revenue, thank you, Ed, or ticket sales, for example, at Fear the Con, thank you, everybody else, I can also counterbalance that against our hosting costs, against anything, for example, commission art that I get from Keith for products that we have in the works, against what it costs to actually put on the convention in terms of renting the halls and such. There's all kinds of things that otherwise I would just be eating as an out-of-pocket expense, but now at least I can put against my taxes, and that doesn't recoup everything, but it does help you quite a bit, and I guarantee you, I save myself in taxes a lot more in a year on Fear the Boot than I spend on the accountant, probably by a factor of at least 10.
I think the saying goes, you may need a priest and a tax accountant, but only one is required, and that's not the priest. Something amenable to that. But I formed a really good bond with an accountant as I was doing my taxes, because mine can get quite hairy as I bounce across the country going from state to state. Make sure you form a good bond with a good tax person.
Well, yeah, at least in Missouri, the process always sounds worse than it is. The actual process of forming the LLC is pretty simple.
Yeah, it's
and really the details aren't hard to understand after you've read all the details. But like everyone's saying, the accounting aspect of it, that's not simple. That's something you do want some help with.
Other advantages of forming an LLC, anyone that you contract, now I did mention artists as an example, but anyone you contract, you have a much cleaner way of doing that because of the fact the LLC can hire this person, can pay this person, and there's a much cleaner line for how the taxes and such are handled. The other issue is going to be ownership. Let me give you some examples. Let's say tomorrow Wayne and I, we go out and decide to take the D. Wayne system I'm working on, Fear the Con 5, and we decide to make this into a published product. I don't know how we would do
that. That's going to happen.
But we decide to go out and make this into a published product.
You pay me and I come to your house and I decide.
But then finally, at some point, Wayne realizes I'm not joking about my bigotry towards gingers, and he and I have a huge falling out. Well, at this point, who owns the D. Wayne system? Or if, let's say, for example, maybe Wayne and I are doing it, at some point, Chad or Pat or Chris give their input, and we don't summarily reject it, then there can get to be some kind of stickiness about who owns what. With a company, this becomes much more clear because the company owns it, presumably, and as people come and go from the project, then that's really immaterial. It's the same way as if you go to work as an employee for, let's say, General Motors, and you help design a car. When you leave the company, you don't get to hang on to that car. Now, this goes into a second area. which is the fact that you need to have carefully recorded written agreements with the people that you are working with. You need to spell out in documents, ideally signed, if at all possible, that state things such as who owns what. What happens if there's a falling out between people? What happens if one person stops performing their duties? What happens with the money that is eventually made off of all of this? You might want something like a non-disclosure agreement.
Who owns the rights as well as the derivative rights? Because that's where DC Comics has gotten themselves in trouble with the Schusters. I mean, it's things like that you really have to think about, even though you don't want to think about it.
Yeah. Let's come back to derivative rights here in a second, because I want you to expound on that with just complete my thought on the NDA. If you guys are coming up with a great setting or a great bunch of ideas for a system, and you have a falling out with somebody, that person runs off and goes and starts something of their own. If you don't have an agreement that says, look, whatever you did here, it stays with this product and you do not have the right to disclose it to anyone or use it anywhere else, this is an important layer of protection. Wayne, do you want to expound on what derivative rights are?
Yeah, basically, when you produce a product, other products can be derived from that product. Let's say, Dan, you create a character, Gnarl the Gnoll. You've also created all of these other gnolls around them. If I go out and create my own gnoll that's part of that society, that is a derivative product. That character is derivative of your society, your gnoll, but you didn't actually create it.
Right.
And that's where things can get muddy if you haven't actually taken the time to think about that ahead of time, is who owns the rights to that character that I made entirely on my own based on your property?
Ed, do you have anything you want to throw in here?
Man, the accountant slash lawyer stuff. Yeah.
No, if wow. Not, that's cool. I just want to at least pause.
Oh, give no, you... I mean, like, I don't know how much you want from it. I mean, look, I worked for a CPA firm for a number of years, and I don't even do my own taxes. You know, I don't even do my own books. There's people that do that stuff for a living, you know, and I pay somebody to do that for me because it's a lot of work. You're going to have to do the own writing of checks and billing and stuff yourself, but, you know, actually putting that into your financials and paying your taxes on time. And then, of course, the stuff about lawyers and contracts, start doing that crap now. And you know what's great? Like, as far as legal considerations for contracts, there's tons of people who just give you copies of theirs, or you could just do some freelance work for somebody to get a copy. Michelle Nephew at Atlas Games, in fact, will just send you copies of all the contracts they use. So if it's not like you have to hire a lawyer, you might still want to say, hey, look this over and make sure I'm not going to get screwed. But there are easier ways than, you know, paying somebody whole tax to set it up for you. But for an accountant, that's the first thing I would do. Get somebody to do your books for you.
Also, on the matter of the accountants, just like you were saying, LLC provides that layer of I'm not going to lose my house. The accountants can also provide something like that as well. If you get audited and you did your own taxes, you're on your own. If you get audited and you have a contract with an accountant that says, you know, we will defend you, you're not on your own when you get audited.
Which is what I have. Fear the Boot and I personally both have audit protection through Devereaux and something or other is the name of my accounting firm. But I have that agreement with them. Something else I want to talk about here with legal considerations is copyright. I'm not going to get into trademarking and things like that, though it's somewhat similar. There's a site I've mentioned on the show before. I'll put it in the show notes. I cannot recommend it enough. It is copyright.gov, especially if you're in the U.S. I realize this isn't going to apply to you as much if you're overseas. However, copyright laws between like the U.S., the EU, Australia, etc., they are starting to come into parity. But if you're in the U.S. in particular, go to copyright.gov. It will explain to you in very simple terms what's real, what's urban legend, how copyright law really works. And this is coming straight from the government. This is not some random dude's website. This is straight from the government. And they will walk you through, for example, with Epoch of Rhysos. I own the setting. I have written a setting appendix as well as a single novel, which I've never done anything with, and we'll talk about that some other time. But I have written that stuff. It is on file with the Library of Congress. If you go out and search their records, their archives, you will find me in there under both. There is a reason you want to register a copyright. Technically, in the U.S., a work is copyrighted as soon as it is in a reproducible format. But there are reasons for wanting to actually pay the $30. It's only $30 to register your copyright. You want to know what those reasons are? Go to copyright.gov, look at their FAQ, explain it. Let's say you have an artist. For example, right now, I'm working with Keith Curtis on art for that setting for Epoch of Rice House. But what I want an understanding between myself and Keith is to say that while he drew the pictures, and I may even say, okay, you own the pictures, I own the concept of what it is you're drawing. You do not own the aliens that you are drawing. There is a copyright form that covers work for hire done exactly under that framework. It's a simple form. It's a relatively small fee. All this stuff is on copyright.gov. I cannot recommend it enough. Don't trust some random dude's opinion unless that some random dude's an intellectual property lawyer. Go to that website, read it. If you're getting into this, it's probably the best 15, 20, 30 minutes of your life you will spend on this. Looking at the time here, it looks like we're hitting up against about the length of an episode. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to call this the end of part one, and we will pick this up again with part two, which works out pretty well because while we were sitting here, I actually came up with an eighth point. So we'll have 4 points in each show. But I do want to close this out in saying something, which I'm sure the other guys are likely to echo, which is that if up to this point, what we're talking about, it sounds complicated, it sounds like a lot of work, let me offer a bit of reality and a bit of encouragement. The bit of reality is, it is. If you are not willing to spend a little money, to take a lot of time, to go through a lot of heartache, to make some mistakes, to find out the hard way what you should and shouldn't have been doing, don't do this. Grab an Xbox controller and do something other than trying to make your own role-playing game. Plain and simple. Is there anyone on the mics that would disagree with me on this?
No.
Is there anyone here who's going to tell me that this is always an easy and carefree and lovely process?
Hell no.
Okay. The bit of encouragement, however, is look, there are other people that have done this. There are other people, including some of those that are talking to you right now, who are in the process of doing it. We are mere mortals just like you. We are not super brilliant people with multiple degrees in accounting and law and English and art and everything else. This is something that if you are willing to set yourself to do and are willing to pay the cost, you can do this. Just don't underestimate the cost. It's like training for a marathon. You can probably do it, but don't have any delusion about this being an easy task. I tell you what, then, you guys out there have a great week, and I wish you the best of luck in designing your games. And tune back in next time when we cover the other half of the list and keep on talking about this. Get your comments out there at feartheboot.com. And while we probably won't be able to integrate them into the second part because we're going to go straight into recording that here in a minute, we will perhaps, you know, be able to use them for future topics or interviews at some point down the road. There's one guy in particular I know I want to get on the show here somewhere along the way to talk about some of this stuff. So thank you guys for tuning in. As always, be sure to check the show notes, and we will catch you next time. Chad's not here, so I'll just say see ya. This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.